It's a privilege to be here today, passing on not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teachings, giving meaning to the practice of all of the great Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche is a Tibetan Buddhist. And so the flavor of his teachings is slightly different from Zen. But there's one that really it touches right on our subject. And I'd like to mention it. It's called Enlightened Genes. And Trungpa Rinpoche says, just as milk has the possibility of producing butter, as human beings, because of our enlightened genes, we have the possibility of producing enlightenment in ourselves. Imagine that. And this, he says, this basic fact or possibility was discovered by Buddha, and it has been actualized and promulgated for 2600 years. Trungpa's concept, enlightened genes, I'm understanding to imply that although we're born with the genes, we need still to create the causes and conditions for them to flourish. So he continues, he tells us, first he tells us the signs that show us that our enlightened genes are being awakened. And then he tells us the obstacles to awakening them. And then he tells us some practices conducive to awakening them. So I'm just gonna share those with you. First, the signs that our enlightened genes are being awakened are, there are two of them, Maitri, or loving kindness. And the second one is self-honesty and clarity. And so with the first, we're more compassionate toward ourselves. And we see that. And with the second, we begin to see ourselves more honestly and clearly. So in other words, when we start seeing ourselves, treating ourselves with more loving kindness, and that we have a greater clarity about who we are, we could take that as a sign that our enlightened genes are being awakened. There you go. And as for obstacles to awakening our enlightened genes, there are four of them. The first he calls intrinsic slavery. The second he calls being without self-awareness. The third, taking part in unwholesome activities. And the fourth, sleepiness. So the first obstacle, intrinsic slavery, means that we set up our life in such a way that we do not even have time to think about it. We're so busy. And so we're just slaves to our lives. So he calls that intrinsic slavery. And I know so many people who do this. It's almost like part of the modern world or something. But we really need to slow down. So the second one, without self-awareness, our enlightened genes cannot be awakened. So without self, we need self-awareness. And third is being lured into activities that destroy our wakefulness and mindfulness. And it could be indulging in the wrong occupation, in the wrong lifestyle, wrong friends, or being against spiritual practice. And the fourth, we're asleep to our lives. He says, conflicting emotions of all kinds are taking place in us, which we avoid by spacing out. So I'm sure all of us do that. So these four obstacles to awakening enlightened genes are very destructive, he says. And you've probably guessed that this idea of enlightened genes and Buddha nature are the same thing. But there's something charming about the idea of having enlightened genes, I think. And then finally, regarding practices conducive to awakening enlightened genes, there's waking up at the right time, like Suzuki Roshi says, waking up at the right time, studying the Dharma, which we're doing right now, and the four Brahma Viharas, those are states of divine states of dwelling. They're divine states of dwelling. And we've talked about them, actually. They're love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. Love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. We've mentioned them, but not in this context of awakening enlightened genes. So I just want to say that it's obvious to me that everyone here not only has awakened their enlightened genes, but you're regularly growing stronger spiritually. And I just would like to encourage you to allow your personal vow, the personal vow that I hope everyone is going to have finished making by the end of this series, and allow it to arise from this excellent energy of your enlightened genes. It's there's something more personal about thinking, oh, I have enlightened genes, than I have Buddha nature. I don't know why. Just, you probably have a different, they're both the same, so don't worry about it. Returning to our subject of vow, it's very important to realize that we're deluded. We live in the reality of life, but we lose sight of it, and we must return to it. So to go back to the reality of life in the midst of the reality of life is our practice. That's our practice. And this practice must be based on vow. And our vow is not a special promise we make to Buddha, but rather a manifestation of our enlightened genes. It's a manifestation of our Buddha nature. We go back to the reality of life within that reality. This is the most fundamental meaning of taking a vow, that we keep going back again and again to the reality of our life with the joyful mind, the parental mind, and magnanimous mind that we talked about last week. So we take those minds back to our vow. The reality of our life within that reality. So all we have is the reality of our life. And since we forget about it, we have to go back to be mindful within it. There's no other place to be. We see this in the kind of amazing spirit of the life of a man named Guishan Lingyu, Lingyu, a famous Chinese Zen master who established a large and influential Sangha in China. Before his time, there was no Zen Buddha, there were no Zen Buddhist orders at all. But then Zen monks started to create their own unique form of monastic practice, and that was the beginning of Zen as a distinct school in Chinese Buddhism. So Guishan was Tenzo. We talked about cooking last week. Guishan was Tenzo, head cook, in the monastery where he practiced with his teacher, Baijiang Huihai. Baijiang, just remember Baijiang, is the teacher of Guishan. And one day Guishan was standing near the abbot's room where Baijiang was staying, and Baijiang asked Guishan, "Who is it?" And Guishan replied, "It's me, Guishan," basically his Dharma name. And Baijiang said, "Would you dig in the fire pot and see if there is a fire or not?" And it was winter, and the fire pot was their source of heat. And Guishan stirred the fire pot and said, "No fire." Then Baijiang got up and came over, dug deep into the ashes, and found a tiny ember. He showed it to Ling Yu, Guishan, and said, "What is this? Isn't this fire?" And Guishan was enlightened in that moment. The fire here refers to the Buddha nature or enlightened genes. They're the same. The fire is the Buddha nature. Buddha nature is the fire of the life force that enables us to aspire to be better persons, to be more helpful and practice the way. It may only be an ember, but all of us have it, and we must find it. And even one tiny ember, if fed with charcoal, becomes a big fire. And this is the meaning of a sangha. We practice together with other people so that together we become bigger than ourselves. And this was Guishan's enlightenment. So then Baijiang sent Guishan to Mount Gui. Many Zen masters take their name from the mountain on which they practiced. And Guishan, as you'll see in a moment, practiced a lot on Mount Gui, which is an isolated and precipitous and awe-inspiring mountain suitable for a great monastery. So Baijiang sent him there, and he practiced there alone for 40 years. Dogen comments on Guishan's practice, which he greatly admired, in a chapter of the Shobo Genzo entitled Gyoji. And Gyoji means continuous or ceaseless practice. And we read from this last week, the continuous practice, you probably remember. It's a very inspiring passage. And for Dogen, Guishan's practice offered an important example of how to establish a monastery or sangha, or ourself firmly rooted in our own Zen practice. And his way, Guishan's way, was first to saturate ourselves with Zazen. And Dogen says, after the bestowal of the prophecy, which means after Guishan's Dharma transmission, Zen master Guishan went directly to the steep Guishan, which is Gui Mountain. There he made friends with bears and animals, lived in a thatched hermitage, and kept practicing. He didn't avoid hardships with wind and snow. He ate only chestnuts or horse chestnuts. There were neither temple buildings nor temple provisions. However, he ceaselessly devoted himself to continuous practice for more than 40 years. Later, his temple became well known throughout the country, and many excellent practitioners gathered there. So that's a passage from Dogen. And people came to practice with him, and his sangha, it is said that he had 1,500 students and 41 Dharma successors. That's just like gigantic. And even though in the beginning he practiced alone, his practice was not for himself. He vowed to create a monastery or sangha to practice with others. And when I hear this story, I feel that his Zazen built his sangha, that his Zazen was so strong and so steadfast that its energetic force pulled ripened ones towards this practice. And we should take note of it because the magnetism of our practice also generates a large force. So he vowed to create a Sangha because that was his enlightenment. And so he sat down and did Zazen for 40 years. That's what he did to create a Sangha. And he was like incredibly successful. But I'm just so inspired that he didn't go around and try to find students or, you know, advertise for students or do anything. He sat down and did Zazen. Dogen discusses the inner attitude we should maintain when we make a vow. He says, our vow should not be based on the human tendency to undertake things that we see as good, useful, or beneficial for ourselves alone, things we expect to bring us fame, profit, or self-satisfaction. Instead, our aspiration should be for the continuous practice of Buddha Dharma. Dogen Zenji continues, even if we don't have a lofty temple building, if we practice, the place can be called a dojo of ancient Buddhas. A dojo means a place for practice. Originally, it referred to the place where Buddha was enlightened under the Bodhi tree. So the Bodhi tree, under the Bodhi tree, was a dojo. Dojo is a place for practice and a place for enlightenment, because practice and enlightenment are one. That this is really very amazing, that we take a vow to be for the continuous practice of the Buddha Dharma, and then we sit, and that sitting creates a dojo. And a single person's continuous practice creates a dojo for many Buddhas. Dogen says, such places are sacred forever. And he continues, we have to quietly contemplate Guishan's continuous practice in ancient times. To contemplate means to think of it as if we were living on Mount Gui right now. Listen to the sound of rain at midnight. The raindrops have power to pierce not only moss, but also rock. On a snowy night in winter, even birds and animals don't come to us. Unless we devote ourselves to continuous practice, valuing Dharma more than our own lives, we cannot stand such a life. And I think this is a description of our Zazen. The sound of raindrops, of birds and animals, are the sounds of our life, and the snow is the scenery of our life. And we don't consider this practice as a step to something else. We talked about this last week. This practice is right here, right now, in this situation, to awake to the reality of this life. This is all what Dogen teaches us, and it's all so important. So Guishan, and this is another quote from Dogen, Guishan didn't hurry to cut the grass, to prepare the land, or engage in constructing temple buildings. he only continued to practice and put his whole energy into cultivating the way. We cannot help but have sympathy for the authentic ancestor who transmitted the true Dharma and who had to undergo such hardships in a secluded steep mountain. And I, which means Dogen, I heard, Dogen says, that on Mount Gui, there was a pond and a brook which might be covered with layers of ice and mist. Although it was too solitary for a human being to tolerate, practice of the Buddha way and the innermost truth vigorously came together there through his continuous practice. Guishans. This is the most important point, that practice of the Buddha's way is not something abstract, but rather it's about the reality of our life. And Dogen Zenji frequently talks about our concrete practice with our body and our mind, and that our personal practice actualizes the universal truth. Our personal practice actualizes the universal truth. Without our small individual practice with this body and mind, this one, the Buddhist teaching, our universal reality, they're the same, the Buddhist teaching and universal reality. It's just an abstraction, something written in scriptures that we read and try to imagine. The universal truth, our life force, can only be manifested through our practice. If no one practices, Buddhist texts remain only words. If no one lives the teaching, it's just another part of our library. It's not alive. Even if our Bodhi mind or aspiration is weak, our practice is the manifestation of the universal truth taught by the Buddha. Even if our practice is weak, it's still that. Without our practice, there is no Buddhist teaching. And that just makes so much sense. I mean, what's Buddhist teaching without me sitting zazen today? You know, just there is no Buddhist teaching outside of that. Just one more word about the power of raindrops. In his comments about Guishan's practice, Dogen talks about raindrops. He asks us to contemplate Guishan's practice in the mountain. We should try to feel as if we were in Guishan's place. So there we are in this very remote, steep, but beautiful mountain, practicing all by ourselves and listening to the sound of raindrops at midnight. And the raindrops have power to pierce not only moss, but also rocks. So Guishan sat by himself in the deep mountain. Our practice of zazen, like his, resembles a raindrop. We are small and can sit for only a short time. Each drop alone has little power, but we still continue to practice. This is the essential point. Our effort is like a raindrop. It doesn't create big change in one day or a few days or a few years, but if we just keep doing it when conditions are ripe, change happens. I love that idea. And when I reflect on it, I think actually I do everything that way when I can, of just very steady little by little, very steady little by little. And that's all I think about is the process of very steady, little by little. We should remember Guishan's example because our actual practice is so important. We need time to work toward our goals, but to accomplish any project, the appropriate causes and conditions are essential. And that's what we lay down. That's what we can do our best at. The cause may be compared to the seed of a plant, and the conditions to temperature, humidity, and sunshine. If we put a seed on the desk, it won't sprout. It needs the right conditions. But when the conditions are perfect, if the seed isn't healthy, it won't sprout. So we must be careful to keep our practice healthy and deeply rooted. We should keep the root of our practice wholesome. I guess that's why Chogyam Trungpa mentioned unwholesome practices as one of the obstacles to awakening our enlightened genes. The smallness of individuals and the universality of reality is the main point in Dogen Zenji's teaching. It can also be described as merging difference and unity. Difference is the individual. Each person is different. Unity means that everything is one. So there's no separation. And this is our reality. We are independent, small, and limited. Yet when we sit in this posture and let go of thought and of our limited desires, we are moved by a vow that comes from the very core of our being. And there is no separation between us and the whole universe. It was a kind of simple talk today. And today is the last talk about vow. So we'll have three, first, second, and third talks just on vow. And then the rest of the series will be the stories of the five Zen masters, three of them being this triumvirate that I talk about: a grandfather Zen master, and the father Zen master, and then the son Zen master. The son is still alive. And then two other Zen masters who are related closely to this triumvirate I want to include. So we won't be talking about vow per se again. But again, I encourage you to be really very seriously striving to answer those 10 questions so that you can write a personal vow for the rest of your life and then be able to make correct choices because you know what you're after. So here are five important points that I made today. First, we hear that ancient people practiced on the ground or under a tree and that such places are sacred forever. A single person's continuous practice creates a dojo for many Buddhas. Secondly, we don't consider this practice as a step to something else. This practice is right here, right now, in this situation, to awake to the reality of this self. Very specific. Third, we practice together with other people so that together we come bigger than ourselves. And this was Guishan's enlightenment. Fourth, there are four obstacles to awakening our enlightened genes, our Buddha nature: intrinsic slavery, which means our life is so busy we don't have time to think about our life, so we're slaves to it. And second, being without self-awareness, taking part in unwholesome activities, and sleepiness. Those are the four obstacles to awakening our enlightened genes. And then fifth, our vow then should not be based on the human tendency to undertake things that we see as good, useful, or beneficial to ourselves alone. Things we expect to bring us fame, profit, or self-satisfaction. Instead, our aspiration should be for the continuous practice of Buddha Dharma. And then there are 5 points for reflection during the week. The first, regarding these four obstacles to awakening enlightened genes: intrinsic slavery, being without self-awareness, taking part in unwholesome activities, and sleepiness. Since any one of these might obstruct your enlightened genes from sprouting or your Buddha nature from being robust, examine yourself carefully. Do you find signs of any of these four obstacles operating in yourself? And then second, why do you think that waking up at the right time is so conducive to awakening enlightened genes? What's the big deal about that one? And third, regarding setting up your life in such a way as to support your highest intentions versus setting it up in such a way that you do not even have time to think about it, that scale, where do you fall? I'm going to repeat that one. Regarding setting up your life in such a way to support your highest intentions that you're going to figure out in your personal goal, your personal vow, versus setting it up in such a way that you do not even have time to think about it, on that scale, where do you fall? So to ask yourself, where do I fall between these two things? And fourth, we hear that to go back to the reality of life, in the midst of the reality of our life, that's our practice. And what does that mean? Can you put this teaching into your own words? To go back to the reality of life in the midst of this reality is our practice. What does that mean? In your own words, what does that mean? And then fifth, we are independent, small and limited. Yet when we sit in this posture, and let go of thought and of our limited desires, we are moved by a vow that comes from the very core of our being, and there is no separation between us and the whole universe. That vow from the very core of our being, that's Buddha nature, and we all have that. So we are moved by a vow that comes from our Buddha nature, and there's no separation between us and the whole universe. Describe a time from your own life when you've experienced this. And it could be a time before you even knew about Zazen, just from a very, very core experience, maybe out in nature, maybe camping, taking a walk. I wonder if there are questions.
Thank you, Gail. So the first question that we have is, I want to ask about sleepiness being an obstacle to arousing enlightened genes. I am sleepy a lot, even though I think I'm doing the right thing in my life. I still find myself in subtle ways not awake to it, not alert. Is there anything I can do about that?
I'm going to answer this question by describing what the opposite of that feels like. When you are awake to your life, you can hardly wait to live it. And there's a sense of correctness about your activities, even if they're hard, there's a feeling of correctness, and there's a natural sense of practice around them. And you just find yourself doing them regularly and completely, and that's all. And there's this feeling of, this is my life. It's very palpable. It's hard for me to address your sleepiness because there's so many possible causes for it. But I can say definitively that until your life resembles the picture I just described, there is going to be a sense of something the matter with it. And it reminds me, so I say that and I'm remembering what I've written about writers. For writers, until you're writing, your life always will feel that there's something the matter with it. Writers need to write. And so if you're not writing, your life will feel like something is the matter with it. And so the real answer to your question that I have is, it really doesn't sound like you're doing the right thing in your life. The signs don't align with the description I just gave. And so I think you should give that a lot of thought. That's where I would suggest that you look to address the question of your sleepiness. Because if you were living your correct life, you would not be sleepy. I don't think you would be sleepy. I mean, unless there's some other disorder like depression. That's all. I hope that helps.
The second question that we have here is, what does Trungpa Rinpoche mean by conflicting emotions of all kinds are taking place in us, which we avoid by spacing out?
So I had an experience of this just the other day. And I want to tell you about it. Very many years ago, I commissioned a statue. I don't know if I can make you see this. A statue of Prajnaparamita. I don't know if you can see this, but anyway, here's the statue. And it's right beside me on my desk. And I think it's my favorite Buddhist statue. It was made for me by someone I know many years ago. And the other day I was in class with a teacher who was talking about our tendency to close our eyes, which is definitely me. And the teacher was suggesting that we practice keeping our eyes open and being aware of the space in front of us and around us and back of us, on top of our heads, and just being aware of our space with our eyes open. And so I forced myself to keep my eyes open. And I looked at my Prajnaparamita statue, and I noticed that her hands that are in this incredible mudra had 5 rings on them, which I've never seen before. I've had this for at least 20 years, if not 30. She has rings on both her pointing fingers, both her thumbs, and on her right ring finger, pinky finger. And I was moved to tears by how beautiful her mudra was with her rings. And I think that's what Trungpa means. Without awareness, everything is too casual and too the element of relationship and our deep relationship with everything around us falls apart. We need self-awareness, and we need consciousness of our environment, and we do need to keep our eyes open. And I think he's saying conflicting emotions of all kinds are taking place that we avoid by spacing out, but we do have, I mean, we all just, I'm just taking that to mean our ordinary mind, which is that. And I think that we all do it. And I think that consciousness is the way to get around that as much as possible. The other day, I just had a chance to see how much I'm missing by not doing it. And I encourage all of you to try to practice this awakened mind all around you, behind you, above you, just as if you're in this big, big circle of energy. It's a very good awareness tool. And as we listed, self-awareness is one of the 4 obstacles that Trungpa lists for not awakening your enlightened genes. Okay, that's all.
So the next question that we have is, we don't consider this practice as a step to something else. This practice is right here, right now, in this situation to awake to the reality of this self. I find these words very beautiful, but I'm not sure I understand the last part. Awake to the reality of this self. Can you say more?
I apologize for using myself as an example again, but the other day I was listening to Tenshin Reb Anderson Roshi give a talk, a teisho, and he used a word for us, the people listening, that the Buddha used to use for those listening to him. And he called it his assembly. And so Reb used the word assembly to refer to those of us attending his talk. And I was shocked. It was like, assembly? Really? Am I part of an assembly? And but then I thought, who else? I've been practicing Zen since 1968. I'm the one right here, right now. Of course I'm part of this assembly, but it felt really weird. It felt weird to say it. And I think that's how awakening to the reality of the self can feel. It feels weird. I never would have raised my hand if someone had said, you know, who is in this assembly? But I urge you to notice this when you're sitting, for example. And at that time, when you're sitting, you are part of Buddha's assembly. So see how it lands in your body. You are part of Buddha's assembly when you are sitting Zazen. Because who else would be? It's right here, right now. And that's you right here, right now, being a part of the Buddha's assembly. And you're welcome and encouraged to think of it that way. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. So the last question that we have is, how would you suggest that we work with the four Brahma Viharas? Love, compassion, joy, equanimity. I love the phrase divine states of dwelling, but they seem too large. How can I ground them in my daily routine?
It's a really good question. And I think probably a lot of us feel that way. You know, they're lovely concepts, and we sort of nod and accept that and then forget about them. And honestly, my answer to your question is to take one of them a year, possibly two. The first two and the second two sort of go together. So let's say two of them a year, and that's all. So for example, for the rest of this year, you would take love and compassion as a practice of extending love and compassion to both yourself and others, particularly yourself, extending love and compassion to yourself. And when you do, you notice that you do, and you make a note of it, and you're very conscious of it, and you can even, you know, thank you very much. I felt that love and compassion that you just extended to me, Gail. And that you can continue till the end of the year, literally. And then on New Year's Day, you can make a New Year's resolution to practice joy and equanimity, which is calmness and non-discrimination. So joy and equanimity for the whole next year. And I used to poo-poo New Year's resolutions, but this year I made three, and I'm really vigorously thinking about all three. So I guess they work sometimes. So that's my answer, to take, you can do one at a time and do this over 4 years too. It's the speed is irrelevant. It's the depth of concentration and intention toward consciousness. Intention toward consciousness. That's all.
Thank you, Gail. That was the last question that we have.
Well, all right. I do want to thank my team, Sahar, and Brian, and Brendan, who make these talks possible with all their work behind the scenes. And I will see you next week when we begin the life story. It will take two sessions, the life story of Kodo Sawaki Roshi, who was known as Homeless Kodo. And we'll begin that next week. Bye-bye.